And what we're doing today is called systematic theology. Now, did anybody venture a guess as to what systematic theology means? Does anybody have an experience just from the title of the word or from your own experience? What, when we do systematic theology, what are we doing?
Putting all the pieces together.
It's internally consistent, that A goes to B, and B goes to C, and C goes back to A.
Yeah, but at least that A and C do not contradict
each other. Okay. Let's put IBM up here. Greg Dancy and Bonhoeffer write systematic theology. I mean, everybody's got their own style, right? So that's one way of getting the job done. Music is another way of getting the job done. The systematic theology is if somebody is sitting down and asking some questions like, what is truth? Who is God? Okay? That's a good question, right? Who are people? Right? These are good questions. What is truth? Now, normally we don't do this on a Saturday afternoon. Alright. So what we're going to do today is we're going to ask you the following question. Who is God? What is the, who are people? And what is truth? Systematic theologian, there are lots of fundamental questions in life, like God and people and the world and the future and all that stuff. And so systematic theologian basically just tries to answer all the big questions. Now, sometimes systematic theology books end up to be, Karl Barth's systematic theology is like 20 volumes. I mean, it's just tremendous. You would, and it's like this long, I think there's 18 pounds to hold it. It's huge. And lots of people have done systematic theology. Paul Tillich is a systematic theologian. Remo Bruner is a systematic theologian. Karl Barth is a systematic theologian. Who else? Tillich. Well, Tillich is going to go with Norman Knutson's husband is a systematic theologian. In fact, just in a week or so, there's a new professorship established at Wartburg Theological Seminary called the Kent S. Knutson Chair of Systematic Theology and Missions. And it's it was established in honor of Norman Knutson. As for Lutheran people in the United States, how could I miss that? I mean, for Lutheran people in the United States, as Kent S. Knutson is as good a systematic theologian as the Church has seen in the 20th century. I mean, it's just extremely talented experiment, and he is very, very good. Okay, so anyway, that's what we're working on today. We're working on some questions of systematic theology. From the biography, you know that we have, from Bonhoeffer, primarily fragments. We do not have 20 volumes from Dietrich Bonhoeffer like we have from Karl Barth. What we have are Ethics, Hidden in an Attic, and Later Assembled. It's not a book, it's fragments of a book. Okay? We have Letters and Papers from Prison. Okay? All fragments, just itty bitty little things smuggled out by a corporal. And I found out the other day that this corporal had arranged for Dietrich, they had a whole route and clothing and a car and all ready for him to escape from Flossenburg. And he didn't do it because they had his brother and his brother-in-law and his fiancée in jail at the time. I know it was his brother and his brother-in-law, and so if he would have gotten out, then they would have been in trouble. So he told the corporal that the whole thing had to be off because his relatives were in grave danger. We don't have 12 volumes of systematic, you know, one volume, three, four. We don't have that. We've got shards. We've got fragments from Bonhoeffer. So what I'm doing today is using Larry Rasmussen to help us do a very quick review of Bonhoeffer's systematic theology. Larry Rasmussen teaches at Wesley Theological Seminary. He's the dean of the faculty here this past summer. We'll be doing next summer. It is a dissertation on Dietrich Bonhoeffer at Union Theological Seminary, Reality and Resistance, and I showed you that book the other day. This is a difficult book to read. It assumes that you've read all the rest. And it uses phrases like the salt Christi without explaining what it means. I had to go look up gestalt, and then I had to go look up Christi. And I still didn't know what it meant. I didn't get at it. Gestalt Christi, the form of Christ in the world, I think is what it means now. So we're going to use Larry's year plus of doctoral research to help us give a 1-hour summary to what we're doing today. If this is reality, okay, if this is reality, or if you want to call it, if this is the world, if this is the sum and substance of all stuff, we're going to talk today a lot about weird things. We're going to talk today about stuff, okay? We're talking about reality. Reality means you, the table, Hagen Village, woods, military power, bugs that crawl on the ground, okay? We're talking about stuff, the whole of reality today. What is the heart and the core of all reality? Okay. Lots of people have lots of answers to the heart and core of what reality is. Money is the throbbing heart of all reality. That's Karl Marx's theory, that at the heart of the universe is cash. That's what makes it run. Okay. What other parts to the universe can you name? All right. Others? No? Yeah? That's a big one in the math. Others? Love. Love either as agape, love, self-giving love, or eternal sex. Either way. What other parts of the universe are there?
Power.
Okay. Well, lots of people who sit around and think about big things, like what is truth and what's the heart of the universe, ask the question, or sooner or later have to ask the question, what is at the heart and the core of reality? When we call somebody a radical theologian, it doesn't mean that they're granola and are kind of weird or something. You know? A radical theologian is a theologian who wants to go to the heart of the matter. Okay? But it doesn't mean that they're just trying to live in Connecticut or something, you know. Okay.
Are you kidding?
No. But a radical theologian is somebody that seeks not to deal with the peripheral, but really to go to the heart and core of the matter. I suppose it's an assumption I make that if someone chooses to become a radical theologian, that they really ought to know what they're doing. Because it's, right, well, I mean, that's an assumption I make. It's sort of like a surgeon who can do radical surgery. You know, when you go to the heart and the core of the matter, you really ought to know what you're doing when you're going in and doing that surgery. So when we're dealing with the heart and the core of the universe, a lot of theologians deal with the perimeter. And that's very important, like liturgy, or education, or mission, or evangelism, or things like that. But a radical theologian is just simply one who goes to the center.
Bonhoeffer is such a theologian, because Bonhoeffer asks the question, who is Jesus? Who are people and what is the world? Hence, we would call him a radical theologian, not because he comes up with left-wing ideas, but because he goes to Harvard. The center of all things. In 1933, remember this sequence, from 33 to 45, Hitler was elected in 33, Bonhoeffer and Hitler died in the spring of 45. That was the reign of the Third Reich, so to speak. At age 33, Bonhoeffer was in his early 20s, 24 or something like that, and he was writing theological essays. He had his PhD 3 years earlier, so he was doing lots of theology at this point. At age 24 or so, he said this: the one who is present in word and sacrament and community is the center of human existence, the center of history, the center of nature. Bonhoeffer went to the core and said that the center of everything is Jesus. That sounds like a nice, pious statement. You know, Jesus means everything to me. Yeah, but please don't misunderstand it. He said all of reality, that is, people, nature, government, and existence itself, all is understood only in Christ. One of the implications of this is that the division between the sacred and the secular is eliminated. This is the pastor's work, that's the president's work. Okay? Billy Graham does this and Jimmy Carter does that. When Bonhoeffer goes to the center and says Christ is the middle of everything, even the bugs that crawl underneath the ground. Isn't that sort of weird? I mean, it's a very bizarre statement to me. What he's eliminating is the division between the sacred and the secular. The implications here are that a Lutheran pastor enters in to Nazi territory later in his life. You see, in 1933 he was writing this stuff. By the 40s, he was leaving the sacred behind and was entering in to the secular. That is, he left the traditional work of the pastor, preaching, teaching, etc., and now was planting dynamite bombs under the Fuhrer's table. But how can you plant dynamite bombs under the Fuhrer's table? You can, because this old division between sacred and secular is simply not true. There is only one reality, and it's Jesus. There are spin-offs from that reality, but the division between the two is simply not true. Now, there's a ton of very smart theological types who think at this point that Bonhoeffer has really dug himself a hole and he's got a lot of problems. And that may or may not be, but I don't really know about that. I mean, I don't read a lot of other things, so I don't know. I don't have any good resources for criticizing Bonhoeffer. What's the sign that Christ is in the middle of reality? What's the sign in the middle of reality? Now, that may not seem to you like the next question, but it is for Dietrich the next question. It's an important question. The sign in the middle of reality is the cross. I'll read some things. In a 1932 sermon, back here, from a 1932 sermon, the wonderful but to many people horrifying theme of the Bible is that the single visible sign of God in the world is the cross. Underline that with your mind. The single visible sign of God in the world is the cross. Not the church, not theology, not anything. The single visible sign of God in the world is the cross. And he makes the comment that for many people that is not only astounding, but it's offensive. But that's what he says is is the heart and core of the matter. And the cross is important here because the Christ is the center. What's the nature of this person who is at the center? The nature of this person at the center is a dying person. Yeah? If Jesus is the middle of all reality, what is there about this person that is most notable? The most notable thing is he's a dyer. He's a death person. He's a give up myself and die person. We're doing systematic theology. We're starting at point A and we're working on down. Okay? Point A is the center of the universe is Jesus Christ. The most true thing about Jesus Christ is that he is a giver. He's a death. He gives us his death. Let me read this statement. Should your poverty lead you into temptation? Christ was poor. Should your godless surroundings lead you into temptation? Christ stood deeper in these surroundings. Should the will of the flesh lead you into temptation? Christ suffered the agony of the flesh even more. The cross is the single visible sign of God in the world. The theme then is that there is power in this weakness. Jesus is the middle of all reality. The most true thing about Jesus is that he died for us. And that says that weakness is power. Now you're Gestapo agent, Gesine. You just read Bonhoeffer's theology. I mean, that's an offensive, nonsensical statement. Okay? Weakness is power. He's swimming upstream right now. Totally against everything that his culture teaches and believes. Weakness is power. Want to ask me something?
No.
Whether it's Jesus, the most true thing about Jesus is the giving. Look up. Ask, you want to say a clarity? Anything?
There's another subsequent question on the power to be what?
Yes. Coming up. Bless you. Yes. Right. So far we're at stage two only. We're going to go through about six stages here in the systematic outline of what truth is.
Stage two is
supposed
to cross on the death.
Correct.
The visible sign is the cross.
Right. Yeah.
And resurrection.
No, the resurrection, the epitome, the high point, the highlight of the year, the big day is Good Friday. Mm-hmm. Huh? The symbol is the cross. Easter lily only affirms the cross. We celebrate Easter Sunday. Bonhoeffer and a lot of other theologians, including Martin Luther, said that the center of the truth is Good Friday. The Easter only affirms this truth. What we've done is we've taken the cross as a stumbling block on the way to victory. Luther and Bonhoeffer and others say the cross is the victory. Okay. This is the, John Fram will lecture on this and you'll get it just clear as a bell. This is the theology of the cross. The theology of glory says that the there's a little stumbling block in the way to victory. Hallelujah, brothers and sisters. Right? But Luther says, no. And Bonhoeffer too. But the cross is the sure and certain sign. This is the truth. Yes. You'll notice in the New Lutheran Book of Worship that the celebration during Holy Week had taken on a whole new cast and tenor. The feeling of the liturgical of season of Holy Week from Palm Sunday, which is now called the Sunday of the Passion, really, in a way, reaches its epitome. The climax of the week is Friday and Saturday. The high Eucharist of the week is Saturday midnight. We'll do that here. We did it last year. The big service is Friday, and then Saturday night is at midnight is the big Eucharist, and then the lights come on to affirm Friday. And the question is, how are we supposed to live? What's the model for our kind of living? And the model that John's going to talk about is cross. The model for us is cross, not Easter living.
Okay.
We now have to say more.
We first said that Christ is the center. We said that the cross is the dominant symbol. Now we're going to say more about the person of Jesus.
Stage three. Pro me. This is not me, it's me. P-R-O-N-E is a Latin phrase. It means for me or on my behalf. I will now read to you from Larry Rasmussen's book, page 18. Are you ready? Christ is not as Christ in himself, but in relation to me. His being Christ in his person, excuse me, his being Christ is his being for me. This being for me is in turn not meant to be understood as an effect which emanates from him or as an accident. It is meant to be understood as the essence, as the being of the person himself. The personal nucleus of Jesus is pro me. Let's see. What is the core of this man? What is the stuff of which he's made?
The stuff of which he's made is pro me, for me.
Without that, okay, this is not easy. Yeah, you're right. You're struggling so much. Go ahead.
Are you saying for me that Jesus is for me?
Yeah.
Or that I am for me and that I am for me?
No.
No. Jesus is for me.
Right. There's the only thing that Jesus is for you. Yeah. That's a right, good way. His core is us. Okay? His core is us. That's good. There is no other core to him. No. His only function is us. That's good. Good. You're looking for a fuller use of the word servant. Yeah, good. That's a good one.
Servant as opposed to butler.
Christ's only reason for being is to be there for me.
It's Jesus.
Jesus as best represented as the cross.
And the cross is pro me.
Now, the ultimate thing to say about Jesus is that he is the man for others. It's a Bonhoeffer phrase you'll hear the rest of your life. The man for others. It's in capital letters and it's all through his letters. The man for others. Consequently, now we're moving on.
Consequently, if it's true that the stuff of Jesus is for me,
then what's true about you? Not that you should be, but your core, the only way you'll know who you really are is to go to the core. As Jesus is the true representation of all of reality, so too as you seek your own reality, who am I really? The ultimate true thing to say about you is the same thing that he said of Jesus, the person for others.
Me? Who am I?
I'm the same thing. That if Jesus is his core is for you,
so our core
is only for others, in Bonhoeffer's understanding.
Bonhoeffer on this question quoted Luther. The heart turned in upon itself. The heart turned in upon itself.
That is, egocentricity is the ultimate and total negation of who we are. The absolute idolatry, his heart turned in upon itself. Heart turned in upon itself.
And that's not Bonhoeffer, that's Luther.
But Luther picks it up, Bonhoeffer picks it up from Luther, and he just runs it all the time. The heart turned in upon itself. Egocentricity is the ultimate sin. All of the sins are a spin-off from that one.
Now, if you are only you in relationship, if your true self can only be found if you are for others, what this means is that there is no, that you cannot exist in isolation. The only way you are who you are, the only way your real self is a self, is with other people. Bonhoeffer wrote it this way, people who are not in community are not people. Now, community doesn't mean holding village, and it doesn't mean joining religion sits in the corner. It means that only as we are with others, only as that pro-me, that for others, is going out of us, are we real? Are we actually who we are? If this is not happening, we are not whole, and we are half. The center of all truth is Jesus. The cross represents the center of all truth. Also representing the center of the truth is that Jesus is for us. What is true about Christ is also true of me, that you and I are only real people when we are for others, and we can be for others only in community. And now, the next statement is really offensive, or at least it's really dangerous. He goes on to say that in the transaction between you and me, as you touch my life and I touch your life, you are God. Not a representation of God. You are God. Don't repeat that to people who won't understand. See, I mean, he... Huh? Who is the other person? The other person is God. Now you see how it progresses? A systematic theologian starts at a place and moves. Bonhoeffer said his prayer like crazy. He prayed like crazy, meditated, read the Bible, all sorts of things. But he felt like God wasn't up there. God was you. Yeah. That might not be strong enough. It's okay to say God is in us. That's okay, but it may be a little weak for what he's really intending. This is the substance. Bonhoeffer's question, he says, just before he died, he says, the question that haunted me all my life is, who is Jesus among us? See, so you're right on the money. Who is Jesus among us? Is Adolf Jesus? Gandhi? Is Gandhi Jesus? Bonhoeffer thought Gandhi was Jesus. Alive today. How we doing, folks?
He doesn't last forever. The Christ in the heart of the Father is pure, and the Christ in your heart is weak.
That's correct. Okay, and he meant that. Literally meant it. But I take it figuratively every time I read that. Yes. But he really meant that.
What about Abimelech?
The Christ in the heart of your brother, the sister is pure, and the Christ in your own heart is weak.
How does this?
What we're talking about here is transcendence. Transcendence.
How do we experience that? Okay? Barnabas said, don't float away to try to experience, to try to have a transcendental experience. But if you float away for up to the heavens, or go to the mountaintop, or get high on Jesus or something, you have a wholly transcendental experience, and sort of blow your mind with it. So you miss the point precisely, because your brother and sister, they are the experience of the transcendental. Now, I think sometimes I've had conversations with another human being, and for 1 hour we talk, or two or three, and after it was over, I walk out the door, and I have a sense in my, just deep within me, and this is not gone off well, I have a deep sense that I just had a very holy experience. Do you understand me? Okay. That there was, I mean, we talked. You know? We understood each other like crazy. I think sexuality can be understood as an expression of a searching for the divine. And if we would condemn Thomas Hughes, we might thus condemn it by saying, you're missing the opportunity for the most holy experience, or as holy an experience as God ever designed for us. I don't want to get into all that. But I'd really like to lift up the possibility that sexuality and human contact is going to the heart of the universe. I don't think he is lifting up people and endowing them with extra power or with sort of, I don't think he's putting us on a pedestal. But he's turning our vision about what is divine and holy towards each other.
Mm-hmm.
The killing of Hitler was in excruciating. Larry documents this thing for 200 pages about what a horrendous, excruciating experience it was. So these people can be better fortune to even think of it, to even consider such an act, destroying us, destroying God maybe, destroying us part of God.
I was in YouTube for a little bit. This is a rerun of what we've done. Who is Jesus? This is exactly what's on the board. It's just made it. Who is Jesus and what would he have us do? We haven't gotten to the what would he have us do part yet. Okay. The heart of Bonhoeffer's theology is Jesus Christ, there are many hearts to identify them, money and power. Whatever. What is the center? Christ is the center. As we see through these glasses, the Christ glasses, we see God. You don't like my drawing. as we see through the eyes of Christ, we not only see God, but we see the whole world clearly. It's another way of drawing it at that. What is the sign at the center? The only one sign, theological crucifix, the cross. The essence of the one at the center. The essence of the one at the center is that he is pro-man. Not that he sort of likes me. Not that he sort of emanates. But the core is that. The heart turned in upon itself is the ultimate negation of ourselves and of what God is in Jesus.
And this is just a continuation of the following.
Then who are we, really? We are, like Jesus, pro-made, for the other, the man for others. The I arises, only one I. The I arises only with the vowel. That's a good, that's a vowel. Get it?
The I arise, you, I only go up when you do. I'm only real when you're real, when I take you seriously. I'm only what I was designed to be when you are what you're designed to be. And when we're together, I'm not. The I arise is just about. What's the church doing? The church, just like Jesus, just like us, so too the church. Same thing, the man for others. The church is only the church when it's being there for others. When the church serves to protect itself, to maintain itself as an institution, it's simply not the church. Bonhoeffer criticized the Confessing Church, of which he was a part. He criticized the Confessing Church because he said it never took any risk. It didn't take big enough risks, excuse me. The church is only the church when it takes risks in being there for other people. That fits into Norma Knutson, what Norma was doing. That certainly fits into what Marilyn Fenn was just doing in Liberation Theology. When is the church in Bolivia? Only when it's there for the peasants. Only there when it's there for people. There is no other heart and core of the church. Now, all this is a systematic approach to the question, how do we make decisions? What does this title, what does this book mean? What's the question? Right or wrong? Okay. This is a question of what's right and what's wrong. In order to understand what Bonhoeffer says about what's right and wrong, we need to understand everything that's just gone on ahead. See? Now the next will be rather obvious. I don't know if I want to... How do I make decisions? If all of reality is constructed by God in such a way that being there for others, that's what they put on the Goodyear blimp if they ever flew over Dietrich's hometown. Okay, that's the phrase, being there for others. If all of reality is constructed by God in such a way that being there for others is the only way to reality or to self-fulfillment or to truth or to peace, then what does that say about the decisions that I have to make day to day? There are two ways to look at moral action, and in Bonhoeffer's understanding, they both are the same. The question that you, as a Christian person, ask yourself is my action in accord with Christ? If you're a non-Christian, you ask the question, is my action in accord with reality? It's the same question. Is my action in accord with Christ? Is my action in accord with reality? If you're wondering about doing something, and you ask, is this in accord with Christ? And you ask that question because you're a Christian. And you come to an answer. Now, suppose you're non-Christian. You've got to have a way to ask questions, too. The non-Christian asks the question, is what I'm doing in accord with reality? And because the center of reality is Jesus, both questions are the same, you see. The magnificent thing about Bonhoeffer's theology is that it affirms everyone who's trying to make real decisions, or decisions in accord with reality. We talked here an hour ago about South America and liberation theology, that in South America, Christians and Marxists are working hand in hand. Okay? Now, the Christian asks in South America asks the question, what is in accord with Christ's will? The answer is that people should eat, that people should live, that people should be free. The Marxist in South America is asking the question, what is in accord with reality? Now they may answer the question, they may or may not answer the question the same way. But if they struggle toward reality, Bonhoeffer says they will answer the question the same way. That people should be free, that people should live, that people should have food. They'll come to the same conclusion.
For about 6 years of Dietrich's life,
he worked primarily with non-Christians in the plot to kill Hitler. Not primarily. He worked a lot with non-Christians. Okay. What's reality? What does Jesus want me to do? Jesus wants me to kill Adolf Hitler. The other people participating in the plot to kill Hitler were asking, what's reality in Germany today? The only reality is getting rid of that guy. Because he is unreal. He's a fantasy. Remember Dietrich's father? When Dietrich was growing up, his father would not permit fantasy in the family. As they sat around in the afternoons, the children had to be precise, they had to tell what was going on, and then be quiet. Playing, dreaming up games was not his father, just didn't allow it, didn't like it. Hitler was unreal. Okay? You've got to get rid of unreal stuff. Let's ask the question today. What's unreal about the way we're living? Well, I mean that we make a season for me. That we could construct a nuclear warhead every day and a half is unreal. I mean, I just that it's an illusion. We're doing it, but it's illusory. It's a fantasy. It's just that it's nonsense. Does it ever strike you that way? I mean, it's so ludicrous that we're putting money into that. Okay. That's now. What are some other unreal things we're doing? Okay. All right. Yeah. Unreal. Okay. What are other unrealities that we're involved in? Single spies. Are they unreal or what? I don't know. Maybe they are real. But I don't know. Just yeah. The question is, see, at the center of the universe, there is reality. Jesus is the reality. The sign of it is the cross. The sign of it is for others. When something is not for others, when Adolf is not there, is not the man for others, he is unreal.
See, this reality in the center here is always trying to pop out. God and Christ is always trying to be the man for others. CMFO, the man for others. It's always trying to
see that? Mm-hmm. In that big yes. That's always trying to pop out. So, our job is to go around eyes wide open and snooping like crazy asking, where is it popping out? Where is Jesus peeping through the crack? Okay? What form is Christ taking in the world today? Go ahead. Oh, no, excuse me. I shouldn't have. That's a good question. No. Person, sometimes, movement, a whole, in lots of ways. Lots of ways. Moral action, moral behavior, is any action that conforms. You hear it coming? Moral action is any action that conforms to Christ. When your behavior or my behavior takes the form of Christ, then the man for others is busting out. Okay? What's moral? A moral action is an action that is in the form of Christ. When we do, this is a good one. This is a simple little statement. When we do the moral, we bring to realization the world's essential character. When we do the moral act, the core of the heart and true center of reality springs alive. Okay? We bring to realization, only a couple questions left. Are there then no eternal principles? are there then no eternal principles on which I should base my life? Or do I just have to forever keep wondering if my actions help Jesus spring out someplace? I mean, do I have any guidelines at all to follow? Or is every situation new? You know, I mean, if every situation is new, that's a little hard on me. I mean, sometimes I'm a little lazy, and is there any way that I can have sort of a corral around me? And Bonhoeffer answers, yes, there are some eternal principles that help guide us. And he called those eternal principles mandates. Mandates. What are the mandates? The mandates are work, family, church, and state. Those four. Work, family, church, and state. Okay? So, how did you do, let's just use an example, work, family, church, and state. And it's sort of a corral around picture here, okay? And the corral is, the corral, and you're standing inside of it, and let's say this corral is work. One of the things that's true is that work is good, okay? work is better than not working. Okay? You ask the question, should I work or shouldn't I? Well, that's a dumb question. Of course you should work. It's one of the mandates. You ask the question, maybe I should just walk out of my wife and kids and go somewhere else. What's your answer to that question? That's a dumb question. You should not do. Okay? There are things. I'm not done yet. Hold on. There are mandates that help us control our lives in four spheres. The state, the church, work, and family. And as we live within those boundaries, the will of God is done. Now, sometimes within things, there's violence. Now what do you do? Sometimes within a state, there is violence. Now what do you do? Okay. When we live in here, with work, family, church, and state, we don't have that many problems, and we don't have that many ethical, in fact, we have no ethical questions there. Living inside of this is pre-ethical. Pre-ethical. The questions in here really aren't questions at all. They're really quite self-evident. And God set it up in such a way that we don't have to sweat a whole lot about what's right or wrong with their life. But there are times when the state ceases to be the state and becomes something else. Okay. Now, in the course of history, with the state or the church or with your work or with your family, become how does it take? When these things no longer function, then we have to stand outside and we have to ask the ethical question. And that's not fun. And it's not easy. Okay. And let me do it this way. The ethical arises only when the normal course of events is called into question. The ethical arises in exceptional times when the flow of history is in turmoil. The ethical arises only when the normal course of events is called into question. It arises only when the normal course of events is called into question. Let's say some more about these mandates. The mandates sometimes cooperate with each other, work and family. Sometimes they complement each other, our family and church. sometimes they contradict each other. It's never simple. They sometimes struggle, and all of the will of God is not found in one of them. The will of God is found in all of them as they struggle and tussle and back and forth and move and negotiate and, you know, stuff like that. The normal course of life. Jesus says they are the things in that make life run. The four basics that make it work. Self-evident truth. Yeah. Natural law. That's another way to put it. Yeah. Natural law. The ethical arises when the natural gets so screwed up that it can't function any longer. Yeah. Then you've got to start asking us for questions. How do we make ethical decisions? We ask, how is Christ taking form in the world? In other words, what is real? We bring to realization the world's essential character. That's what Christ is doing when we make decisions that conform to Christ's will. Do I look for eternal principles? And this is, I'll skip this part. Do I look for eternal principles? Bonhoeffer said, there are no eternal principles. There are none. I'll skip that. That's different. Okay. Thou shalt not kill, is that an eternal principle? Bonhoeffer said, nope. Sometimes you kill. Is this hard? Yes, this is hard. That's right. The mandates make life function. And if you choose to stand outside of the mandates, you are out on a limb, and you're in a difficult time, and you're out there struggling with the ethical question. In the 60s, Bonhoeffer was a real hit in America. Okay? And they just picked out that section out of ethics here and just quoted that sucker like crazy. I don't know what you're going to think about. That's all about good times. Jesus' name on there. We didn't read the rest of it. Yeah. That's a fascinating thing that Larry points out in Reality and Resistance. This stuff was, in his doctoral dissertation days, he was writing this stuff when he was 19 and 20 and 21 years old. And he uses it when he's 35 and dies at age 39. And Larry points out the fascinating how it was there from the beginning, in his early stuff. Now, there's also a tremendous change that occurs in a lot of it. And it's not like he has a one clean, closed system, brought up at age 21, completed at age 39. No, that's not true either. So it does shift and move and grow and all sorts of. In fact, the thesis of the entire book is that Bonhoeffer's Christology and the experience of killing Hitler are just like a confluent river. That the experience of the resistance changed his Christology changed his resistance work. The two just blend together. And as a movement happens here in the Christology, here a movement happens in the resistance work. They blend together. However, so that's the other side of it. But one side is to say that from the beginning there are these groups, from age 19, 20, and 29. There are no eternal principles. I've got to do two things. I've got to know the situation. You've got to read movies, time, and good stuff, as much good stuff as you can find, and you've got to know what's going on. In addition to that, you've mixed that up together in the pot. You also mix up the Word and the Church and Church's tradition and Christ. You mix that up, and then you let Christ happen in your decision. That's where you put it. You let the form of Christ come out in your decision. Are there any guidelines? Yes, there are. The mandates, they are the media of Christ in the world. Church, work, state, marriage, and family. Now, if you had only been here, if you would have walked in the door and heard, "Bon Appa says there's no eternal principle." Well, you think, well, this is nice, this guy's a lot of fun, he's nice and shallow, and he'll kind of bless anything I want to do. Well, I hope you don't get that impression from this whole plea. I doubt if you will. I hope you don't. See, the eternal principle that he was struggling against was an eternal principle like the state is divinely ordained. The state is divinely ordained. He struggled his whole life with that. And finally concludes, "My responsibility is to destroy this state. As I destroy the Nazi state, as I participate in its destruction, am I guilty? Yep. But there is no eternal principle that says this state is divinely ordained." So in one way, he cuts us loose from moorings, you know, he sets us adrift. But we're not totally adrift. We've got the mandates to live by. But still, there are times when the mandates don't work either. And we've got tough decisions to make. But guidelines for those tough decisions. The guideline is what? Simple. The man for others. Yep. So we're not cut adrift, are we, after all? There is an eternal principle, the man for others. Thank you. Oh, good, I'm glad we stayed long enough to get back. Are there any eternal principles? I suggest that after reading this one, that the agony that a couple would go through as they thought about divorce, that there's this horrible personal agony of that decision, is no less than the agony that Dietrich and his 14 friends went through over the Nazi state. But they were just in tremendous depression over what they were doing. They just were nauseated over themselves for what they were doing, but they felt they had to do it. And I think the analogy of divorce really follows. I mean, you're never sure of what you're doing. You just do it. And we go back to the beginning. Dietrich, one of his forms of praise, you play music or dance or know how to do this thing or work or you want to do something. Okay. That's a form of praise. Each one of his is systematic theology. What you can do, too, is you can write your own. It's got nothing to do with analysis, sit down and write a systematic theology. But what you can do is say, okay, if that's what I believe, then what does that say about B? Then C, then D, and then decision-making, and then, how does it all hang together?